pull up a chair. We're so glad to have you join us here on the Back Porch Education Podcast. For the next half hour or so, we're going to talk about all things educational. It's a wonderful day to learn something. Glad you could join us. Hello, whatever time of day it is for you. Welcome back to the podcast. This is Steve with my friend Jason, and we're going to pick back up with our conversations about virtue today. And if you hadn't guessed, let me anticipate for you the fact that my friend Jason has a poem to start us off again. Jason, take it away.
All right, Steve. Well, not only do I have a poem for you, but I've got a quote. We're going to start off the...
A twofer. This is like a deal.
Yeah.
I'm excited. All right.
Right. So here's the poem we'll start off with. It's by the bard, William Shakespeare, and it is Sonnet 94.
I love his titles.
Yeah. He's great. 150-something of them, I think he has. So here's the 94th. They that have power to hurt and will do none, that do not do the thing they most do show, who, moving others, are themselves as stone, unmoved, cold, and to temptation slow. They rightly do inherit heaven's graces, and husband nature's riches from expense. They are the lords and owners of their faces, others but stewards of their excellence. The summer's flower is to the summer sweet, though to itself it only live and die. But if that flower with base infection meet, the basest weed outbraves his dignity. For sweetest things turn sourest by their deeds. Lilies that fester smell far worse than weeds. So I feel like that's pretty appropriate when we're talking about virtue. We want to encourage our students, if you're gonna fester, you're better off being a weed than a lily. But but let's talk about this quote too. I pulled this quote from Aquinas' Summa because it's a wonderful way to kind of wrap up what we were talking about last time with Aristotle, this whole doctrine of the mean, right? This idea of virtue being in the middle. What Aquinas is going to tell us here is that when it comes to the four cardinal virtues, sure, moderation can be what we aim for. But when it comes to the theological virtues, faith, hope, and love, there is no such thing as moderation. We want to do that as much as we are able. So he'll say it better than I just did, but here it is. God himself is the rule and mode of virtue. Our faith is measured by divine truth, our hope by the greatness of his power and faithful affection, our charity by his goodness. His truth, power, and goodness outreach any measure of reason. We can certainly never believe, trust, or love God more than, or even as much as, we should. Extravagance is impossible. Here is no virtuous moderation, no measurable mean. The more extreme our activity, the better we are. What do you think about that, Steve?
Well, I love it because one of the major points of us doing this podcast is encouragement, and there's a great deal of encouragement there.
Yeah.
Anyone can educate, but the best educate with Christ at the head, not themselves or some big idea. This notion that I've got to somehow be held ultimately responsible for my student is a huge pressure. And for the Christian, ultimately, they're laying their student and their own best days and worst days in the classroom at the feet of Christ and saying it is but filthy rags, but you're certainly capable, God, of being the kind of God that I can have faith and hope and love in. And, right. And I want my student to do the same. And so if you're in the enterprise, it's good. And if God's absent from the enterprise, I think the opposite of faith, hope, and love is all you can hope for, and to play on the term hope.
That's right.
The Middle Ages, which often, you know, get condemned as the Dark Ages, kind of took from the pagans, from the non-Christian lovers of virtue, mm-hmm. All the good, and then wrapped it up with a biblical cloak at the heart of it, being these transcendent virtues, these theological virtues. And kind of instead of looking at the golden mean and vice on either ditch, which has still got its place, mm-hmm. they did a very powerful thing educationally and started talking in terms of opposing, of having seven virtues and seven vices. And I think that that's a great way to sort of wind things up, because a wise teacher's mm-hmm. got to be able to identify both, right? Can't just fasten on the positive. There's got to be an occasional assessment in the negative. We and our students will fail at virtue from time to time.
Yeah, that's right. So let's look then. We talked last time about the four cardinal virtues: prudence, temperance, courage, and justice, and the three theological virtues: faith, hope, and love. But Steve, I've got an activity for you. How well do you know your virtues and vices?
Well, I would probably say I know the vices much better than I know the virtues. Okay. My wife would probably agree. But right. What's your game? Let's hear.
Okay, so the game is this. I'm just now, you can't look, and we're just doing it on the honor system. And I guess we can always edit it out if you're wrong. But let's do this. I'll say a virtue, one of the medieval virtues, one of the seven. And I want you to tell me what I guess it wouldn't be corresponding, the antithetical vice is. Okay, so you up for that?
All right. We'll see.
Okay.
Right. Okay. There's only seven.
That's
what
right.
Do I got to have? I've got to get five of them to pass? Is that
right. Yeah. All right. That's right. So here we go. Let's start with one. It's not too bad. The virtue of diligence.
Thanks. Start off with one I know so well. Did I mention I've raised four boys? I guess the modern terminology would be laziness, right? But yeah. I love the book of Proverbs, and I learned the book of Proverbs through the King James Bible. And so, you know, it's the slothful man.
Good job. Okay. What about humility?
Well, okay. Another easy. You're making this easy for me.
Well, I don't want to make it too hard.
Thanks. Pride.
Good. What about temperance?
Okay. So if temperance is controlling myself, especially in my actions, I'm pretty sure that the medievals would have made the opposite: gluttony.
All right. Good job. I thought that one was harder than the first two. So well done.
Temperance. You said temperance. I thought drunkenness. Right. But then I recognized they probably aren't just going to limit it to
drink.
You know, if that's where my reading of the Puritans helps,
because right.
they talk about them glutton a great deal.
Very good. Okay. What about, I'm going to give you a hard one now. I got to think about this one. The opposite. Tell me the opposite of the virtue kindness.
So we got to think about how they meant that.
Yeah.
Because our society, kindness is making me feel nice.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that that's where they were going with that. What would they have meant by kindness?
Do you want the Latin?
Oh, that would help me tremendously.
Okay. Okay. The Latin is humanitas.
Oh, just being human.
Yeah. Right. That's right.
Okay, that is a help, because then I think the definition that they would have been aiming at is being human towards them, empathizing or caring, compassion, being the kind of person that I see the guy that needs a cup of cool water, I give it to him in Christ's name. So what is the opposite of that? I mean, meanness is what's coming to my mind, but that isn't right, really.
Okay, well, I'll tell you the sins that you have left are...
Multiple choice. Excellent.
Yeah, exactly. Let's bring it down. You have lust.
Okay, and that's greed. The opposite of love.
Right. Okay, good. The opposite of chastity is lust. You have greed.
Ooh.
Wrath. Envy. Those are what you have left. So you have
Because I'm trying to
greed, wrath, and envy.
Oh yeah, I'm trying to. So it's more like a matching. So I'm trying. Right. I'm matching the ones I know. So let's see what I have left. I've been in the classroom too long. So wrath, I know, is the opposite of patience.
Good job. I always mess that one up.
Well, so do I, and thus I know. So that leaves me greed and kindness. I could see being opposites, but I'm fairly confident that greed's the opposite of charity.
Yes.
So what did you say? Really? So
kindness,
the only one left is envy.
That's right.
And that is right. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Kindness and envy. Now, you said lust is the opposite of love. And yes, as it's written on my chart, it's chastity, right? So, okay, good. There's that. But kindness and envy, that's a hard sell. I don't know. I don't see it.
Well, I do. It's a harsh judgment. Mm-hmm. It's telling me at least certain forms, what's often perceived by people to be mean, if that or unkind, is someone not caring about the other as much as they care about themselves. I want mine more than I care about yours. And that's interesting.
Yeah. And I think the Latin does help there, right? This idea of being human and being, you might say, whole or satisfied, and then the sin of envy being the opposite of that, right? Being proclaiming yourself unwhole, like you want something else.
Yeah. Well, I think the fascinating thing here is that in this conversation of virtue, what we have to remember is that it is summative. That all of these combined make a human fully alive. And of course, we're going to have our proclivities. We're going to be better at some of them and worse at others. But I just know at this point, what our listeners really want to hear is, great, I get the sense of what virtue is. What does this have to do with the classroom? Can you bring this into the classroom and make it real for me? And I think we certainly can after the break. While this show is a back porch discussion, it does cost a little bit of money. So if you're liking what you hear, consider helping us out. You can simply use the donation button on the website to send along a one-time gift, or we have subscriber plans for those who want to commit to regular support. Subscribers can get premium rewards depending on how nice a chair you pull up on the porch. We have everywhere from sitting on the floor to our finest rocking chair available. But whatever you can do, know that it helps us keep the conversation going. And for that, we heartily thank you.
Okay, Steve. So let's put some skin on these virtues then, right? Let's figure out where we see these and how we can encourage and how we can cultivate these virtues.
All right.
As far as I can tell, that's going to happen in four sort of steps or four different ways, right? And that is, they are to model the virtue.
Okay.
To establish routines that coincide with that virtue.
All right.
To praise virtuous habits when you see them, or even virtuous acts when you see them. And lastly, to create opportunities for your pupils to embody that virtue.
It's terrible that that has almost an evil sound to it. Right. All right. So let's make this real. Let's take a virtue. Tell me what it looks like.
Okay. I'll pick courage.
All right. So you said the first thing we would do is model courage in the classroom. What's that look like?
Yeah. So I think one way that we could definitely model courage is by getting in public shouting matches with the principal.
Oh, yeah. Well, right? That's excellent. That's virtuous.
Yeah.
Or just attending sporting events, right?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Now, okay, don't yell at your superiors, but, well, not publicly anyway, but really, you do mention the ball field. I think that is a fantastic way to model courage, right?
Yeah.
You show the students, hey, this is what it looks like to be courageous. One of my favorite things about teaching at the school that I was at was when we had our faculty versus students soccer game. Oh, man, it was fantastic, right? The opportunities to model all kinds of virtues were all over the place there. The virtue of kicking with your right foot was one that I never was able to model, but there were a lot of others.
But you courageously attempted it anyway.
That's right.
And the students respected your attempt at that.
Well,
so the modeling to me is I want to say obvious, but we all feel the weight of that. My students aren't going to be what I'm not, and so the modeling is there. You also mentioned establishing routines.
Yeah,
what does that look like for Kurt?
So I think it can be as simple as having a set aside time. Maybe it's a day or a part of a day where you read about courageous characters and courageous acts, right? So here is, I don't know, Achilles comes to mind. And maybe they're a little, maybe he's rash and not courageous sometimes. But, you find these courageous characters, David, and look at their lives and tell those stories. And that becomes a routine the children know that it's going to happen, and that sort of pushes that model in a little further, maybe.
Right. It just becomes the way we're courageous around here,
right?
Type thing, and they know that that's the way. I like that you included your third recommendation or step towards virtue in the classroom. That being the praise of it when you see it. I spent 7 wonderful years of my life, but 7 years now that I know so much more, I would kind of like to have back and try again, working with middle schoolers. Mm-hmm. And finding praiseworthy moments is sometimes a challenge, but it's so powerful.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, so praise, man, they eat it up.
Yeah.
And it's really a powerful tool. And I think it is dignifying. I think that students are owed praise when it is warranted. It's a great thing to do.
Well, it kind of goes along with number 4, right? So
right.
As teacher am in the lesson planning mode, and I'm thinking through, okay, I want courage in the classroom. I'm going to assign them this moment of public speaking.
Yeah.
And that scares the living daylights out of many students.
Sure.
So when they even get it halfway right, I'm going to praise the dickens right out of them for that attempt. So by creating opportunities, you're creating opportunities to praise them.
Yes.
Don't miss it. Don't miss it.
Right. Right. Exactly. So with praise and creating opportunities in terms of courage, I would say praise the student, not only the one who pushes through timidity, right? Of course, praise that child. That's great. When a shy child pushes through being timid, absolutely praise them. But also, this one's a little bit harder to see, the brave child or the courageous child who checks being rash.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's really important.
Yeah.
So just real fast, for opportunities with courage. I think this one's pretty easy. The ball field comes to mind, but create opportunities for not only for competition, but also for collaboration. Because those, when mm-hmm. people are collaborating, there's a lot of opportunities to not only push through timidity, but also check being rash with one another.
Well, and I don't want to get in trouble by saying something untoward, sure. but education makes a big deal these days, and rightfully so, for maybe students that are bucking up against some severe disability, but it's gone out into the normal playing field, this notion of scaffolding.
Okay.
What I see in the scaffolding movement is that I'm trying to almost remove any possibility that they're going to fail. And you don't build courage if there's no possibility of failure.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't want to sound like the cruel jerk, but I recognize, especially my senior seminar class, they're taking on adult books. They're taking on Plato. They're taking on Aristotle. In not my boiled down version of them. They're reading the dudes, right? They're in Aquinas, breaking their teeth on his heavy stuff. And it builds virtue in them. It builds the virtue of courage. I can do this. Mm-hmm. And so just the act itself, certainly I praise them for how well they've gotten it. But by putting a book in their hand, I'm creating an opportunity for them to build that virtue. Almost sure. The opposite in some regards. I'm gonna take for just a second here and talk about the virtue of humility, which I think Augustine was the guy who said that there's basically three key principles to being a good teacher. And the first is humility.
Oh, great.
Right. And this, just to finish it up, the second one he mentioned was humility. And then the third, shockingly, was the opposite of pride. It was humility. So modeling it, being humble, you know, this is a test for any teacher.
Yeah. How are you going to model being humble?
You typically know more than they do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of this is what's, I think, truly meant when we talk about meeting the student where they're at. Yeah, some of the teachers I meet are to me, they have the right to be proud. They know 15 languages and they've read this and done that and obtained these degrees. And, you know, they're a 60-year-old mature life student.
Yeah.
Who knows a lot and sure. Has obtained quite a bit of reason to be proud of what they know. And when they walk into a classroom with a 15-year-old, the notion of a steamroller comes to mind. Thinking,
right.
You know, that poor kid isn't going to open his mouth lest Dr. So-and-so just rolls right over. So some of the best and most learned professors I had in college were the best because they were ever bit as much a student as I was.
Yes, I agree. That's huge.
On any given day, they were just as excited about thinking, pursuing the truth in the classroom as I was. And of course, I was paying them to teach me, but it was almost, sure. I realized rather early in teaching that it's a very selfish profession in the sense that I get way more out of most classes than my students do.
Mm.
If I come in not settled on my attainments, but saying, you know, this is going to be interesting. This is going to be great. What are we going to find today?
Right.
And I think that there are small little routines, at least in my area of teaching humanities, parents who come through or visitors who come through the school are sometimes shocked to find me. Well, one with the desks circled up, I can't stand the everybody facing the front.
Rows.
Yeah. We circle the desks right. up. It'd be better if we had a good Harkness table to sit around, but those are very expensive. So we just circle up the desks, but they find me seated.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in some cultures, everybody else stood up and the teacher sat.
Really?
Yeah. Christ, the Jewish, the rabbi was seated
okay.
and everybody stood and listened. Which is interesting.
Sure.
And I have no qualms about Socrates or whomever with a peripatetic, you know, walking down the road's a great time to teach. It's just hard to take 20 kids with you. So
right.
The best I've got is a circle, and that's the routine. They know that I'm going to sit down. And when I do that, I have stated, today is not lecture, me telling you what I know. Today is us pursuing the truth together. And I don't have to say that. I don't have to reaffirm that to them every day. Just the act of sitting down and being at their level, he's in a chair just like me, I think is a routine that helps a great deal in that regard. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. So what about habits? What habits would you praise?
Well, with humility, I think that there's two obvious habits that I at least beg from my students. One is ask questions, and I don't mean content questions. Sure. I don't mean yes, no questions. I mean real questions. Because at the heart of humility is the notion, I don't know. So being willing to ask questions, and then I already tipped my hat to the other one. That phrase, I don't know. Do you know how difficult that is for some teachers to say, and students? Students are worried it's going to hit their grade.
That's right. Unfortunately.
If they admit ignorance, now I've got an F. But teachers, you know, it's just damnable pride, right?
That's right.
You can't possibly know everything, man. So admit right. it.
Just get it out of the way.
That snotty-nosed little kid asks a question. Don't jump down. You shut up. You don't know what you're... Wow, that's a great question.
Right.
Praise the good habit. I don't know. Model for them what the real student, whatever his age, has to say in order to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I want to go. I want to find out. And then, of course, we've talked about this, but I think creating opportunities for humility sounds, again, somewhat cruel.
Right.
But again, just like you need courage so my students know in my classes that they face the summative assessment.
Ooh.
The end assessment is going to be essay. At the end of all our talking and thinking about whatever, they're going to have to write. And I thought about it. You know, my father, when I was growing up, was a photographer, professional photographer. And there's a great deal of courage in knowing just when to click that shutter. Or an artist standing in front of an empty canvas, that first whatever, right? And you're watching Bob Ross. What's the first thing? Well, he just covers the whole canvas in black or something. Yeah. Wow, that's courageous. That's going to be ugly unless
he
saves
it. Are you
sure? But that first whatever that you do as an artist is laying – that's a very courageous act. So in writing, they're going to receive a reflection back, right? They're going to receive – for me, you don't just get the big – A at the top of the paper. So you get that flowing red rivers of ink, you know. I'm going to try and help you improve your thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Feedback.
And there are certainly students that resist that and hate that and stick their mommy on me and that sort of thing. But I know that student is gaining the virtue of humility by how they respond to that. I have to be humble in how I give it to them. I can't sit there and crush them. But I've created this opportunity by giving this assignment for us to have mutual praise, but also the need for humility to recognize I think I may have given a few 100s, a teacher that gives it 105 to, what does that mean?
Right.
But most of the time, really good writers are getting upper 90s.
Yeah.
But there's that admission. It's not, buddy, it can't be perfect.
Right.
If we changed the tables and I was writing for you, austere, experienced teacher that I am, it wouldn't be perfect.
Nope.
So and you would have the right to point out its weaknesses, just like I'm trying to do with you.
Well, and you would hope that they would. You would want them to see the weaknesses, right?
Right, because at the heart of it are those three transcendentalists, right? I have faith that God's at work in their life. And that my humble attempts to move them forward are going to, my faith is not without reason. And it's my love for them and for Christ and his kingdom and for the world that he's created that I even think we can talk about this. And then I think one of the fundamental aspects of teaching is this big word, hope. And that's a virtue. That's one of the transcendentals. How would you model hope in the classroom, Mr.
Oh boy. Let's before I get into hope, maybe we can take a break. I can have 30 seconds to think about it.
All right then. Hey, during this brief break, I wanted to encourage you to use the share buttons we have on our website in order to help us get folks tuned into the show. Our goal is to encourage as many educators, homeschoolers, NFL punters, and donut makers as we can with these podcasts. So help us get the word out. Share our Facebook page, send folks a link to one of your favorite episodes. Do whatever you can to help us share this craziness with either your best friends or, if it's more appropriate, your worst enemies. We will love you all the more for sharing our love. Thanks. And now, back to the show.
Okay, so hope, right?
All right.
This is a hard one. this is a little less tangible than courage, but let's dive in. How am I going to model hope? Easy. I am going to refuse to be worn down by the monotony of the third quarter. The perfect, never-ending, no-break third quarter.
There you go, man.
Yeah. No, I do think school or whatever, life sometimes does get a little bit monotonous. The drudgery creeps in, but this refusing to be worn down, I think that's a big part of hope and a big part of modeling it.
All right. So what kind of a routine would a class have that dealt with hope?
Okay, well, like courage, I said read about courageous characters. I'm going to fall back to reading here too, and I'm going to say read stories, but I'm going to take a note from Aquinas. Rather than reading of hopeful people, here I'm going to say look to God, read stories of deliverance.
Okay. Yeah, so that makes sense to me. Kids get well, God save them, he can save me.
That's right, exactly.
My students always love it when I pray before a test.
Yeah.
For them.
Right.
So what am I looking for to praise in the case of hope? What does that look like in the class?
Right. Hopeful habits or praising hope. All I have for you on this is a story. When I worked as a cashier, there was a manager who was called for returns all of the time, right? So his name was Brian, and we would say, Brian, please come to the front for a return. Well, Brian did not like processing these returns, right? Because it was when somebody would come in and they had a grievance, they'd say, this product doesn't work or whatever. And they were often frustrated. So it wasn't something that anybody liked to do, but Brian was always called for it. And one time I was in the back, somebody called Brian to the front for a return, and Brian looked at me before he walked up to the front. It was just us in the back room, and he looked at me and he said, he put his finger up in the air and he said, I'm waiting for one return. And in that moment, I knew that he was talking about the return of Christ, right? The eschaton.
Yeah.
And so Brian had turned this part of his job that he did not enjoy into a, what do you want to call it? A memory aid or a remembrance of something that is very beautiful. And that was big for me, man. I think about that a lot.
Good. Good. And how do we create opportunities of hope?
Excessive pop quizzes?
You come in and hit them every day. They're hoping that maybe tomorrow.
Right. No, I really, okay. This is, again, it gets hard to make it concrete, but I would say this. Paint vividly the eschaton. Paint vividly this world, this kingdom of Christ, that your students might become enamored by it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the long goal is key, right? This is where the Christian mindset just wins here, right? Because this isn't it. There's more. College isn't the sum game. It's moving in the right direction, perhaps, for many people, but it's or the big paycheck or the fantastic job. That's all waiting in the wings for the real show to begin, you know. And that's so, right. I think just a person whose heart is, as you've said, just vividly in love with the eschaton, with where all this is headed, with eternity burning brightly in his face, he taught them. We need to wrap this up. Mm-hmm. This is not just both you and I have experience with older students, but quite a bit of experience, at least on my end, with younger ones as well. And wanted to mention as we end things up that the medieval use of virtue and vice is really great. This is why fairy tales are so good for young kids, really young kids, to see the difference, to see the antithesis, to see that's good, that's bad, that you should be like him and not like him. And I feel a whole episode coming on at some point about moral imagination and developing the good and the evil in children's souls through good literature. But that's another one. This podcast is more than long enough. Let's close it off, and we'll see you next time on the Back Porch Education Podcast. Well, thanks again for joining us in this great conversation about education. We hope you will not just listen, but participate. Leave us a comment, suggestion, or thought on our website. You just never know when we'll use it on the show. Until next time, pursue joy and learn something.